So just as some insight for you as I kind of make my way into sermons, I mean, I have two chapters to dig into this week and at least six great stories out of there that we can poke around. And thankful for Steve and Greta being able to share because they pulled one that I didn't pull from. And as I look through there's a lot of things kind of helping me choose which one of those things are. Some of that is just this net of things that I know going on in people's lives, etc. And some of it is just really, really personal. And so this week it was one of those personal ones. As I went through the stories, I just needed a close, tender Jesus. And that's just my own experience this last week. I needed a Jesus who wasn't just doing big miraculous things or proclaiming all these glorious things, but really, really close and tender. And so when I ran across this Canaanite woman, my own heart pulled me back to that. So I don't know if that's where you are this week. I pray that God has something for you, but I know it was the one that fed me the most in this season of my life. So there was this tenderness about that drew me to that. And so, Ron, you can throw the next headline up there. It also was a little bit of a challenging story for us, too. Imagine the news the next day after that story broke in Canaan, right? The Christ insults Canaanite. It is a challenging story because what we hear in the words of Jesus are not the words that we would expect Jesus to be saying. No one ever really quotes that or has the little cross stitch on their wall, you know, of Jesus saying, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel. It's not right to give the children's bread." Like that doesn't show up on any of those Thomas Kincaid paintings that we have, these glorious statements of Jesus. We don't hear songs written about that, right? Are you going to craft an own song about, yeah, only the lost sheep, you know, only the children of Israel, not the lost sheep somewhere else? So it's pretty confusing because of that. And so I think it's a simple thing to get around. But important for us to understand what's occurring in this scenario, how this kind of out or plays out for us. This can be confusing anytime someone is kind of going along in a normal frame of conversation and then suddenly slips into acting out a different part. Right? So this can kind of go on. And what we have here for a couple verses is we've slipped out of normal conversation into a theatrical performance. Jesus has taken on a different character than what he normally does. And we see that when we go to a theater, pretty obviously, right? You walk into the theater and you look at the stage and you expect on the stage that those are not the real ideas and actions and motives of those human beings up there, but they are portraying someone else, right? We get that. When that happens in everyday life, then that's a little bit more surprising, a little bit more challenging for us. Maybe an example of that is an individual, Stephen Colbert. I don't know if you're familiar with him at all. He's had a, I feel really loud there. All right. He's had a comedy show for a while, and now he's doing late night. And his whole gist has been to portray, I believe, I don't know him personally, I believe he's probably a pretty committed Democrat and pretty committed to those ideals, but he portrays this ultra-conservative Republican ideal. So you have to understand when you watch that that's not his honest feelings on the inside. He's portraying something almost on the opposite. So this whole little acting scene is generated not by Jesus himself, not even by the woman, but by the disciples. If you look in verse 23, you see the crux of the reason this whole thing gets going. This woman is crying out in verse 22, "My daughter has a demon, she's sick, she's possessed, will you help?" And Jesus doesn't say a word. Note that, beginning in 23. Jesus doesn't respond. He says, "I'll see what my disciples do." Kind of a midterm check-in, right? We're halfway through to the cross, seeing what you guys have learned from me. How are you going to respond, right? Here's how it goes. And they respond with where their hearts are, at least in that moment. Send her away. She keeps crying out. Right? There's no reason for her to be engaged in this whatsoever. And so Jesus then responds to the statement of the disciples with a short little acted out scenario. Right, and it is one that is dripping with something known as sarcasm. Now, maybe you think that has no place in Scripture at all, and certainly no place in the mouth of Jesus, but it's what happens in the next couple verses. Sarcasm, if you're not familiar with it, like as a technical definition, is using the opposite words of what you really mean, either to poke fun at something or to stab at it behind its back or whatever else it is. Jesus isn't necessarily making a joke, but he's using it to prove a powerful point. He takes the position of the disciples And he says, okay, you really think that's the way it is? Then let me take that position to the end extreme. Let me just dive into that position for you so you can see how it sounds when it comes back at you. Right? So Jesus dives into the whole area of sarcasm and crafts out this whole experience. And there's a play that follows along. There's two characters in it, just a mini play, right? It's only got one act. The whole thing is kind of tied up within a couple lines of dialogue. Here's the cast of characters as we see them presented for us. All right, Ron, you can go to the next one. There we go, the cast. Jesus is one of the actors in the play. He is playing the role of who? The disciples, right? In verse 23, they said, this is our viewpoint. So Jesus says, all right, I will now act as your viewpoint, right? The Canaanite woman also gets to be a part of this acted out play, and she plays the role of who? Jesus. That's why it gets confusing, because you have Jesus playing the role of the disciples, the Canaanite woman playing the role of Jesus, and you got Jesus on alternate sides of that, but that's how the thing works out. So I think just so we get this really clear and never have to worry about this ever again, I thought it would be nice, because it's only two different individuals and there's only four lines of dialogue in the whole play that we have, if we just go ahead and become thespians this morning. Right? So it'll be easy. I have the dialogue written up on the screen. It'll appear in a moment for you. So we'll just divide it right down the middle here and everyone will get a part, okay? So you over here, you seem fairly holy today, so I will let you begin as Jesus. Okay, you will have your Jesus, and you over here also are wonderful people. I'll let you be the Canaanite woman, okay? So now, if you are Jesus, what role will you have in the play? Right, so when you see the line Jesus and the words after it, will you speak? No, because even though you are Jesus, for the purpose of the play, you play the role of the disciples, and you're the Canaanite woman, so when you see the line Jesus, what will you do? Speak. Perfect. All right, if you can both stand up, both Jesus and Canaanite woman, disciples and Jesus, stand and kind of face each other a little bit. You can look at the screen over there. You can look at the screens over here. You got multiple options, so you'll be good to go on that one. So you kind of have a sense of actually saying it to each other, okay? We'll follow along. You are the Canaanite woman reading the words of Jesus. You are Jesus reading the words of the disciples. The disciples will start. Go. All right, and now the Canaanite woman will respond, or Jesus, in the place of Jesus. The disciples will return. And then Jesus concludes by saying, all right, well done. Good job. Yeah, if you guys ever lose your jobs, you can find a role somewhere in theater. I think you have an opportunity for that. So I changed the words a little bit from what happened in Scripture, but you get the gist of it, right? It begins by saying the Messiah is only a Jewish kind of thing. It doesn't exist for any of those other people out there. And then the acknowledgement from Jesus is, but they have the same wounds you do. Right, there's no need that a Jew has that a Gentile doesn't. There's no need for love or salvation or blessing that exists in your life as a Jew that doesn't exist in their life too. And they say, well, God needs to focus on us. We need to be the priority. We don't want God to run dry. That's really their whole concern. What if God gets distracted? What if God cares so much about the masses around the world, he forgets about me and my own issues and my own problems? And can't we focus a little bit more in on that? And the theological truth that Jesus wants to unveil is your God is way too small. Right? That's the truth he's presenting here. Now there is a healing, and right afterward when he says, watch this, he does it. He casts out the demon. The woman's daughter is whole and healthy and blessed. Right? But that's not the deepest aspect. There's layers in what Jesus is doing. And there's this very superficial one, not in a bad way, but for that woman, right? Her own daughter, her own family was transformed in that moment. But that doesn't really do anything for you. What comes out of that is a teaching Jesus says, I want to bury in your heart. I want you to learn something about the nature of God and my way of approaching this world that's very different than the way you approach it. And so even though there's a healing there, it is about the teaching, which is the larger statement that we want to get to, that we want to dig into our own hearts, right? We exclude people because they are not like us. That's where the disciples were, and in all honesty, we have the same thing that they say. That's not some old-timey kind of experience. Every single person here, in the quiet of your own heart and your mind, has excluded somebody else because they were not like you in some category, way, shape, or form. Hopefully we do that less and less as we mature in our faith in Christ. But I know it still shows up in my life. Even when I don't want it to, it probably still shows up in yours as well, right? It's a fairly common experience. When I had my surgery a couple weeks ago, I had probably for the first time in my life, 5 or 6 days where I couldn't really move around all that much. Got to be really stationary. So I did read a lot, just book after book after book after book. So one of them that I had found a while earlier, someone donated it to the church. I'm like, it seems interesting. Is this book called Midnight Jesus? It's written by Jamie Blaine. And it's just his stories. What I like is it's really, really raw, really honest. Just his experiences with Jesus. He has no pretensions about having all the right answers, about coming to some grand conclusion at the end that solves everything. He's just saying, this is where I've ran into Jesus in my life. And he's got a really fascinating life. One of the jobs that he has, and he's in his 20s, a younger kind of guy, and has multiple jobs, as a lot of people in their 20s do. One of the jobs that he has is working at a psych ward. So he works at the psych ward. He also does crisis hotline calls and goes out when people are in need. And so it's a world that I haven't spent a whole lot of time in. But here's a story that he shares from the middle of that book, kind of dealing with that. He says, a few months back, I pulled some strings. I risked a lot of trouble, and I came in on my day off to take a van load of psych ward patients to church. Just pause for a second and imagine. Like, we're already in the service a little bit. What if that door opened right now and some guy comes in with 9 other people and they try to find some place to sit somewhere, all from a psych ward? You can guess what they look like, what they act like, all those kinds of things. Right? He says we were not treated like lepers, but we weren't exactly welcomed either. I probably shouldn't even tell this story, but it is true. In fact, it's more than true. I didn't try just once. I tried 3 times at 3 different churches, and the results were just the same. I don't know what to do with that. I'm not mad at anybody. I don't want to criticize, but it confuses me. It really breaks my heart. I think we made the church people uncomfortable. Maybe they didn't know what to say. Maybe for some, it hit too close to home. Too much of a reminder that if it were not for grace, it could be them. Truth is, it was kind of awkward for everyone. A really fascinating challenge for us, right? It's so different to read it when the disciples do it a long time ago, and we can just sit back and judge instead of looking and saying, man, how would we respond? When there's a group that's clearly other, that isn't like us, right? It's so easy to exclude. There's got to be some other way for them to get to know Jesus. Not like we don't want to know Jesus, but just not in that kind of community. What are the other ones that might fit within there? Change it from a group of mentally ill individuals, from a psych ward to a group of Muslims, dressed just like you would imagine Muslims to be dressed. Are they going to walk out of here getting hugs? Having been embraced? What if it's a group of transgenders? Meth addicts. Not people that are past meth addicts that are now healed and whatever, but are just in the throes, in the midst of whatever it is they face. The homeless, or even on the other side, you got Wall Street bankers. Or fill in whatever politician is on the other side of whatever fence you happen to be around on. Would they get a hug? Right, not just a mental assertion of, I embrace you, not just this acknowledgement, I know that God loves you in some category and can you find somewhere else to be, but do they find this welcome? Right, so that challenge rubs into our hearts too. What if it's not even in this scenario? What if it's, and that's a lot harder to imagine, a whole group kind of coming in here, but what if it's just out on the street? and you find any one of those categories of people, do you walk on by and find your own way, or do you move out of your way to acknowledge them? What if it's in your school? I will guarantee if you're a high school kid, there's someone mentally ill in your school. There's someone Muslim in your school. There's someone transgender in your school. There's someone on meth in your school. There's someone homeless in your school. Like, do you walk on by because they're not part of my crowd? Someone else can take care of them somewhere. Happy for you to love them, God, but it's not like my deal. Right? So you begin to see that this teaching of Jesus can settle in our lives. Right? It's not an intellectual truth about the Jesus who died for all people, but is it this real embrace out of our own lives that we step into those things? Jesus embraces because he likes us. He embraces because he likes the mentally ill. And he likes the Muslims, and he likes the meth addicts, and he likes the homeless, and he likes you. That's it, right? That's enjoying people because Jesus does. That's his heart. Will that be reflected in us as well? So there's one more story I want to share from Jamie's book for you today. He has multiple jobs. So this one occurs at a roller rink. He is a DJ at a roller rink as well, too. And so I'll just let you listen. On Thursdays, I go straight from the church counseling center I work at to the rink. I like to get there early so I can skate around the empty floor before we open. There's something about rolling across slowly across a dimly lit floor. Finally, the front door opens and my co-workers arrive, so I skate up to meet them. "Whose birthday we got tonight?" I ask Jesse while Jenny turns on the snack bar lights. "No birthday party," she says. "Private party." "Private?" I reply. "Who?" Jesse points out to the parking lot. "Them." Plastic girls everywhere. Same perfect clothes, same perfect hair, gaggled up, giggling, streaming toward the rink. Jesse reads it from the calendar, the Inter-Greek Spring Fling Mixer. "What?" I ask. "Sorority girls," Jesse answers, 76 of them. I'll go get the door. The girls pour in, smelling of sweet tanning lotion, the distinct stench of cheap Mexican food from the Los Pollos Locos next door. "Whoa, chicas," I say, waving my hand in front of my face as a pack flies by. "Burritos y margaritas? You know it," shout five blondes who look exactly the same. They strap into skates, wobble to the floor, I kill the lights. Call out on the mic, "All the ladies in the house say," 77 voices whoop it at once, "Ho!" And while the intro to Brick House kicks in, I hit 10 spinning disco balls, both banks of strobe lights, all the smoke machines at once. The sorority girls scream, they throw their hands in the air, and I'm the only boy in a building filled with fun time girls. "It's the greatest job in the history of the world," I tell Jenny, a shy education major. "I think a few of the girls might be tipsy," she says in a deadpan voice. "These fine ladies," I say in their defense, "no way." As Brick House fades, I flash all the lights and segue straight into Party Train, Kappa Deltas, Phi Mu's, Alpha Omega Phi's, singing, bumping behinds, dancing with the hands to the sky. The atmosphere plateaus when a dumpy green bus from the Foster group home rattles up to the rink's front door. An attired woman leads in a cluster of ragamuffin, awkward kids with dirty faces and tattered and mismatched clothes. They press behind the woman, holding hands, grasping at her pants, staring at the disco lights and darling gaggles of roller booty sorority girls. "It's a private party," we explain, in the kindest possible way. Jenny's handing the woman a consolation prize of free passes for a family night when the sorority leader skates up with her second in command. Both of them have ribbons in their hair that perfectly match their shorts. They have t-shirts with their names embroidered on the front, Abby, Emily. They stand with their hips cocked, staring at the woman and her raggedy clan, and we're stuck in the middle waiting for somebody to speak. "Are they staying?" Abby asks. It's your party. I tell her, up to you. Emily leans down with her hands on her knees and looks the children over, and a smile breaks her face. Y'all like to skate? She says. The kids nod and squeal and squiggle with Jill. Hush now, the woman says to the children. They do, quiet but giggly, ready to burst. How much is it tonight? She asks, riffling through her purse. For a group. We'll have to count and figure, Jenny says, shooting me a knowing look. Just go ahead and let them start getting skates. Are you sure? The woman says to Abby and Emily. We're sure. Of course. I stand by the side and fan out my hand like Willy Wonka at the factory gates. All right, kids, I say, are you ready? In a screaming frenzy, the children rush the counter. The sorority girls meet them there, unlacing shoes, helping with skates. They hold their hands and they lead them around the floor. It was happy before, but everything now is brighter and lighter. It's higher, the music louder, the mix of group home kids and college girls, skating, helping, falling down, hooting, laughing, having a good time. I autopilot the music. I pocket the wireless mic. Jesse, Jenny, and I meet them on the floor for the crazy trio. It's a roller rink game where you lock arms, you skate in groups of three to the tune of Green Onions. And when the whistle blows, the trio turns and goes the opposite direction, kind of cracking the whip as fast as you possibly can. There's bodies that fall everywhere, and you get up from there, you find a new trio, and you move on. I'm rolling backward between Jesse and Jenny, and it's quite the sight. 30 little urchins squealing with joy, grabbing grimy hands with sparkly sorority girls in press shorts, perfect ponytails. This is the greatest job ever, I shout as we fling each other around in the history of the world. It's a true story. It's the same story of Jesus and the Canaanite woman, when you would never see them being mixed. And God says, my greatest delight is to bring them together. You have a place with me. Right? And here is God's greatest delight to bring things together. And I believe that when Jesus was on that cross, and he looked out over all of humanity, including you, including every other group that we've excluded at some point. And he said, greatest job in the history of the world.